Welcome to Life as a Patient Doctor, where we transform my blog into an audio experience. I'm your host, MedPsych Moss, navigating healthcare as a patient and a future MD. Embark on a journey of vulnerability as we uncover the realities of trauma and developing resilience. Hit that follow and join us on this extraordinary life as a patient doctor. And now for the show. Today I'll be talking about my fertility preservation during medical school, which means I froze embryos. So I'll be reading a little bit from the blog and also sharing a little bit of context on my journey. The blog post specifically is called Fertility Preservation During Medical School. And I'm going over this, even though this was my second time that I went through follicle stimulation process to remove my eggs. But this is the time that, since I knew a little bit what was happening, since this was my second time, I was able to blog more about it and really explain my process. So for those who don't know, during my second year of medical school, I was diagnosed with endometriosis through an endoscopic-like procedure. And when they did that, they actually saw, in addition to endometriosis, my fallopian tubes were clogged. So when I found that out, I freaked out because, knowing medicine, being a medical student, I realized that when I wanted to get kids, I wouldn't be able to naturally. Now, my husband and I were both medical school at that time. We had talked about having kids post-medical school, post-residency, post-fellowship. But now in this health condition and health state, I learned that technically I was infertile or wouldn't have to go through with assisted technology. This blog post will go through this experience, all while I'm still in medical school. Week one. I went into the fertility clinic, and the first thing they do is they get a baby follicle count. So what they do is they do an intravaginal ultrasound, which can get really close to your ovaries and can look at what naturally, without any additional hormones, how many little follicles you have that have the potential of releasing an egg. So I have a picture of my ultrasound where you can see that they're counting all the little follicles that I have. And then I write a last minute surprise cost to embryo freezing. So at first, I was just going to freeze my eggs, but after talking to the fertility specialist, who is an OB-GYN and specialized in endocrinology and reproduction, she said that since my husband's here, why not we just make the embryos and freeze them as like a just in case. So this is what we do, because the first round, I was only able to get one. And when you put them in for actually IVF, to actually see if they will actually attach the uterus and grow into a fetus, that not all the time works. So you have to have a good amount of them. So here's my second time I go in, I say, a last minute surprise to embryo freezing. I learned I had to prepay the amount of 1 month's rent in order to freeze embryos, which is one thing not covered by the Illinois health insurance mandate for fertility and infertility treatment. This facility had me prepay before giving me the amount of medication I'll be doing during the cycle. During the previous follicle stimulation cycle, the hospital just provided the bill at the very end, which gave us time to plan how we were going to pay. But thankfully, we were able to split the cost between two credit cards and then submit the medical expense receipts to the financial aid office to increase my student loans. And then something that, you know, you can do that for any medical expense that your insurance won't pay for if you're taking student loans, which is a godsend. Unfortunately, it took a couple of weeks to refund the money, so we were very close to not making rent. This situation once again demonstrates the social economic barriers to IVF and infertility care and fertility preservation, which I talk a lot about in other blog posts and other writing, just how ridiculously expensive it is to go through assisted reproductive technology. It can cost tens and thousands of dollars just to get these special hormones that you have to inject, get all the doctor's visit, all the ultrasounds, do the procedure to remove the eggs, the procedure to put it back. It's so expensive. So individuals who have infertility or cannot reproduce on their own, whether because they are LGBTQ or they just don't have the organs or bodies, or they've had cancer before, they are going to have to use reproductive technology. And it's really sad how ridiculously expensive it is. So there is a lot of social economic barriers. But like I said, I will talk about that in other podcasts, and you can read about on my website, menspsychmoss.com. All my writings are there. Next, pills. And I have a picture of me holding my estradiol pill, which is a form of estrogen used to increase estrogen levels and keep the ovarian follicles available for stimulation. So that was the first thing that I did. Now, I do want to mention, I'm not a doctor yet. And even if I was a doctor, this is not medical treatment. This is not medical care. Every single fertility is different and their process, and each individual medication and stimulation is different. So please ask a doctor, ask a fertility specialist. This is my own journey and my own medicine recipe for my body. So the first week I took estradiol pills 3 times a day, which is TID, to increase the baseline of estrogen in my system, which started pretty low. I freaked out when I realized these pills were not part of my previous acquired IVF medications. As some of you know from my previous posts, these IVF medications cost $10,000, and I worked forever to get my medical school health insurance to pay for all of them until I found out there was a state mandate that makes insurances that are from schools or employments pay for it. But that took a long, long time. It took a lot of energy, a lot of time, and a lot of tears. Thankfully, these little aqua pills were just sent to a regular pharmacy. So there are two types of pharmacy. There is regular pharmacy like Walgreens, CVS, that they have most medications that you do. However, for these injections and these hormone medications, you have to sometimes go through a specialty pharmacy where they're super expensive and you have to go through all these hoops to get them paid for. Another nightmare. So usually it's super expensive, but I was so glad that these estradiol pills, because they use them for other medical treatments, they're pretty common. I could just pick them up at my local pharmacy and my insurance covered it this time because I was prepared. Next, I talked about actually going in and comparing prenatal vitamins. On my first cycle, I kind of did vitamins, kind of not. I was like, do I really need vitamins if I eat healthy? During that time, I was going through my leave of absence. So there was so much stuff going on during that time. So I didn't really have vitamins, but this time I was like, I'm going to make sure I get prenatal vitamins to get all my nutrients. When I went to the pharmacy, I was taken back because there are so many types. It seems everyone had a different one. And I took a picture of them, of just 3 different kinds, not advertising any of them, but each of them are slightly different, but then they have most of the same vitamins. So I was like, do I go based on like the percentage of vitamin? Do I compare which one has iron, which one doesn't have iron? Do I go tablets, gummies? Do I go by price? It was just, there was so much. And I'm in medicine. I'm a medical student. How in the world, if I struggle, how are other people that aren't in healthcare, how are they supposed to figure out? So then I write a little bit more. Wait, I thought prenatal vitamins are only if you're trying to get pregnant, not if I'm freezing my eggs or like doing the stimulation. And apparently not. According to a 2019 review of studies on the micronutrient status, those are the little vitamins and little nutrients, the impact of preconception, multiple micronutrient supplements, so vitamins, on female fertility. And I linked to that in this blog post, this review study that looked at many different studies, looking at tons of different vitamins that are and what are actually important when someone's trying to do egg stimulation. And this study found that adequate levels are important for oocyte quality. So that's the baby egg, you can say, maturation, fertilization, and implantation. Whereas antioxidants are vital to reduce oxidative stress, a process known to impair infertility. So once I found that study, I read it, I was like, okay, this is important. I should make sure that I do start with vitamins because it's been found it is helpful. Okay, now how can I tell all the different types? So I did more research and I broke down, well, what are these micronutrients they're talking about? One is folate levels, which are important for oocyte quality, maturation, fertilization, implantation. Next is zinc, which has been implicated in ovulation and menstrual cycles. Zinc and certain B vitamins improve DNA synthesis, which is fundamental in the development of the oocytes, like the baby eggs. Then vitamin A, which levels are a factor in oocyte quality and blastogenesis. The egg and the sperm, once they come together, actually growing and dividing in cells. Folate and zinc influence apoptosis, which is normal cell death, essential for regulation of follicle atresia, which is cell death, degeneration of the corpus luteum of the oocyte in the ovary that stays in the ovary after the egg is released. There is something called the corpus luteum that stays there and actually releases different hormones, specifically progesterone, to tell the egg to keep going. It tells the uterus to prepare for fertilization and implantation and endometrial shedding, so having a menstrual cycle. Folate, vitamins B6, B12, D, and iron all have roles and mechanisms that could affect fertility, including homocysteine metabolism, inflammation, oxidative stress, and embryogenesis. One study found that folic acid supplementation in women undergoing IVF helped optimize homocysteine pathways and follicle fluid, which was associated with better embryo quality and a greater chance of becoming pregnant, which was a twofold increase of monofollicle fluid folate, was associated with a 3 times greater chance of becoming pregnant. So in summary, folic acid was helpful to help people who are trying to get pregnant, and for the embryo to mature correctly. I have the article linked, and then I posted this by the CDC that really compares vitamins, why they're so helpful. 1 in 6 women is iron deficient during pregnancy, and it's highest amongst non-Hispanic Black women and Hispanic women. Fewer than 1 in 5 U.S. women take a prenatal vitamin containing iodine during pregnancy. Globally, more than half of children younger than 5 years old suffer from vitamin and mineral deficiencies. I didn't know that. This is just learning more about every single vitamin and why it's important. And the link is on that blog post. Okay, let's go back to my journey. Week 2, injections begin. So the first injections were Menupure. And I actually created little TikTok style videos that you can see on my YouTube page. So like a complicated mixing of different medications. And it's crazy that even as a medical student, it was so hard to be able to remember, like, how many times did I mix in? How many injections did I just do? It was very stressful. If it's stressful and hard for me as a medical professional, how is it for someone who doesn't do anything medical professional, who's scared of injections? This fertility journey is difficult. The biggest side effects that I put was exhaustion. Seems to me the main theme during this cycle, possibly because I was also doing a clinical rotation for part of it. Thankfully, my residents usually let us go early, so I usually got in an hour nap before dinner. Oh my goodness, I remember this. I think I was in neurology, and I was in neurology stroke care, and thankfully, we did sitting rounds, so I felt less dizzy, but I was just so tired, and I had to wake up even earlier than I normally would to inject, to prepare. Like, it took like good 10, 15 minutes to prepare the medication, inject it, and then get ready for the rest of the day. Some people have to actually do injections at work, which is super stressful, or in medical school. As I've been more aware, as I've been applying to residencies, I've been asking around, like, what happens, like, if you are breastfeeding? And only some places really are explicit or have a lactating room in a good place. And in lactating rooms are a way that a lot of individuals can do those injections or take care of their health care. So I really wish there were more of them and those were more accessible, because not all the time can you go from one side of the hospital to the other side of the hospital to take your medications or do a lactation and then go back. A lot of little things to think about when you're a patient and a doctor or a medical professional. And this is actually from my journal that I wrote down. Ugh, I'm not feeling well. I have a headache. And I feel out of breath just from walking up a couple stairs. Oh, there's so much pain and swelling of my abdomen. It was just one injection this morning, but I feel like I've been doing them a lot longer. This was always super hard, especially since I had endometriosis. And then when I injected into my abdomen, I could get bruising or just gas or pain, and any type of movement pressure in my stomach abdomen area would just exasperate in pain because of my endometriosis. Then I actually have a picture of myself. I am sitting. It looks like I'm wearing scrubs. I have a heating pad on my stomach. I have my computer where I was switching between trying to understand all the medications that change every single day. It was a very complicated schedule. And then also probably studying UWorld or doing some questions at the same time because I was in clinicals. I then have a picture of my stomach from the first cycle, but it gave a good idea of like what my stomach looked like. And I stated, if I was doing a physical exam on myself, I would describe my abdomen as diffusely tender with maximal tenderness in lower quadrants, voluntary guarding of lower quadrants, bruising surrounding the umbilicus, decreased bowel sounds, and no rebound tenderness. So a lot of big words, but it's the way doctors talk to describe all the different symptomatology that I was experiencing. So if for some random reason you have that, it could be injections. And I have three different medications, the Novurel, Menopur, and Leuprolide. Novurel is HCG hormone. Menopur is a mix of FSH and LH, so follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. And Leuprolide is a GnRH agonist, so just the description of the mechanism action of what those special names of medications are. So to deal with all this pain, I used a heating pad, took baths, took acetaminophen. I forgot this until later on, 81 milligrams of aspirin, because as your estrogen goes up, you have a greater chance of blood clots. So that's why they had me also do aspirin, but no ibuprofen, which was sad because I needed decreased inflammation, but we can't do too many things at once. And then also I have a history of stomach ulcers, so I try not to have ibuprofen. Next, I have a picture of, again, my follicles. This one's after I've been going through hormones for a bit, and it says right over a 12, left over 11. So that's pretty exciting that my ovaries did have little baby follicles that were growing. Next, I wrote maternity clothes as an infertile individual. This is explaining when I wear maternity clothes, which was really hard that I had to get maternity clothes when I was infertile and I wasn't actually pregnant. So very emotionally difficult experience to be going into a section where people are very happy and like, oh, when's your baby? How, like, when are you due? And then I was like, oh, I'm actually not pregnant yet. And I'm actually not doing this to get pregnant right now. It was emotionally very hard. I would get these infertility pants, which was helpful because it put the least amount of pressure on my stomach, which, as I mentioned, was super, super bloated and painful. So I'd wear them on the days that I had the endometriosis flares during the follicle stimulation or just for my hypertonic pelvic floor pain. And this is what I wrote. It is emotionally painful and embarrassing to need such clothes because it makes me feel fat and makes me remember that I can't actually have kids naturally. That my bump won't magically become a baby, and it will just be more painful. I also don't want people to ask how many weeks I am because I'm just in a flare. Doesn't look like much, but I feel like I am 3 months pregnant. In reality, stuffed with little water balloons. It is actually not that far off, as many follicles in my ovary are growing to a goal of 18 to 20 millimeters or 2 centimeters in diameter. I have about 12 to 14 follicles on each ovary right now. From a medical perspective, I have to be careful not to twist, run, or overwork myself, which could increase my chance of an ovarian arteries twisting, which could cause ovarian torsion. And if you have ovarian torsion, unfortunately, it's most likely that they have to go in for surgery, untwist it, and remove. So don't want that to happen. And my first time I did this, I was so close to that happening because I had to pay for rent. I was in my leave of absence, so I couldn't take a sick leave off. And I was like, no, I need to do this. And I taught a Zumba class with feeling like this, feeling all bloated. And I remember I was teaching a class and I just got this like sharp 10 out of 10 pain. I wanted to vomit. And that's when I realized like, oh, that's why the doctor says I shouldn't do exercise or work hard or walk around a lot and twist, a lot of dancing and twisting, because I could actually twist my ovaries, because you have a massive ovary that can very easily flop over and twist and cut off the circulation. So thankfully, if it did happen, it was momentarily and it was able to untwist, but that shock really scared me. And I was like, okay, I need to figure out how I can do this. Maybe not teach Zumba classes, just teach yoga classes or sitting Zumba classes for older individuals. I kind of shifted around my schedule. But to think about it from like a medical perspective, if you're in surgery, if you're a surgeon, you're twisting and standing for long periods of time. So it's really hard to do these fertility preservation or follicle stimulation during surgery. Also, if you're constantly having to get up and walk around the hospital and doing rounds, it's again really hard, which is a challenge because a lot of medical providers, specifically doctors, struggle with infertility. It's actually twice the amount. Actually, 1 in 4 doctors struggle from infertility when the regular population is 1 in 8. Just because of all the stress, the older age of doctors by the time they start having kids. Not all medical students can take the time off, or residents can take time to do all these medical procedures. Next, from an endometriosis perspective, the follicles were enlarging so much, they were touching my hormone-sensitive endometriosis lesions, which caused a lot of pain. This stimulation round, my doctor is following another regimen that's more slowly increasing my estrogen level, so it doesn't go as high as fast as last time, which we think is what caused me to be in way worse pain the first time I took it, and actually something called hyperstimulation ovarian syndrome, which I'll talk about in another episode. And I put, this time I purchased maternity pants, which don't have a band around my abdomen, which causes me so much pain throughout the day. No jeans, no leggings, and sometimes even scrubs I definitely can't have. A lot of mixed emotions while having to purchase these pants. while dealing with infertility and not having kids in the future. It's so painful to have to look at myself wearing these pants because it's not like I'm pregnant nor fat, just in pain. I have a picture of myself. I'm wearing a black maternity pants and I'm wearing one of my school's from Patagonia. So I'm probably on a clinic rotation during this. So I'm going to go to week 3. Continued injections, increased protein. I need to eat 10 grams of protein a day to prevent the rare side effect of hyperstimulated ovarian syndrome, which is when fluid leaks out of blood vessels into the abdominal cavity. I had this side effect last time I had my stimulation cycle, so I really want to prevent it this time. This time I prepared. Last time I was just like, oh, I'll make protein smoothies like just once a day, maybe twice a day. Then when I got sick of them, I'm like, I'm okay. This time I was going to make sure I had enough protein. So you can see the picture where I got tons of protein shakes, protein bars. And this is how I broke it down in order to eat 100 grams of protein a day. For breakfast, I had 30 gram protein shake or a 10 gram latte or in a 20 gram protein bar. The milk was probably where I was getting the protein there. Mid-morning snack, I would have a 10 to 20 gram protein bar. Lunch, I would have a protein heavy snack, about 20 grams of chicken, meats, eggs. Afternoon snack, 10 to 20 gram protein bar. And dinner, again, protein healthy, 10 to 20 protein. And then for dessert, I had a protein cookie, specifically protein. So much protein. And you did get sick after a while of it. Some protein heavy meals were like almonds, chicken, beans. I made chicken and bean enchiladas, bean and chili meat, and Greek yogurts with nuts. But it was still really hard to stay on top of eating this much protein. I'm eating when I'm not even hungry, which ended up making me feel all nauseated and bloated. And I have a picture from Johns Hopkins that actually talked about the different proteins of all common foods, which was really helpful for me. Next, I wrote, is hormone brain a thing? If not, it should be. My little follicles were growing so slowly, which we did want, but also not fast enough because I wasn't following the medication recipe 100%, which is why I said this of hormone brain. And I explained, I've been so stressed with school that I have messed up my injection cycle. I was positive I only had to take 175 units of Follistim each night, but then I realized that it was supposed to be 300 units. I kept making silly mistakes like this, and now I have slowed the growing of follicles and will not get them removed on the planned day. This messes up the rest of my week because I have planned meetings, clinic, and even a conference out of state I'm planning to go to. Now I just have to practice patience and wait for my next ultrasound on Monday to see how big my follicles are. That will help us determine and help the OB-GYN endocrinologist decide what specific day to remove. So I was just so angry at myself that I messed up the regimen because I was working on such a tight schedule, especially as a medical student. Towards the end of the week, I started Ganrelix at night, which was a GnRH antagonist. My estradiol had risen above 600, which is around the levels of ovulation. Therefore, this antagonist inhibited my pituitary, which is up here in the brain, from releasing naturally luteinizing hormone, leading to an LH surge, which would stimulate my ovary to ovulate. So we did not want that to happen. We wanted to control my body. We didn't want my ovaries to naturally ovulate because we wanted to go in and actually remove them before that happened. So this told it to slow down. And I have a picture of me picking up one of the injections, and you can see my beautiful medication box with all my little injection medications, cleaning supplies, pills. I liked this box because the first time it was just so complicated to keep everything straight. Last bit, nausea all the time. This week's theme has been nausea, especially while in the passenger seat of the car. I usually do not like to take ondansetron, which is Zofran, because it causes me the not so fun side effect constipation, which also impacts my endometriosis and makes it so painful to go to the bathroom. But in this situation, I just had to do it. And I ended up taking it almost twice a day because I was so nauseous. Then I have a picture of me showing on my ultrasound a really nice follicle that it hits the necessary 2 centimeters. So this was part one. I will then go to week four in the part two, which I'll go over the removal week of what it felt like and what happened to actually go through and what it felt like on that day of removal and post that day. If you want to read more about this experience and my other posts regarding infertility, follicle removal, preservation, you can go onto this blog post and look at all the other things I've written at medpsychmoss.com. If you actually have infertility yourself, I have an amazing group of infertility resources that I have used, including clothing I've gotten, how I've stored my medications, things that I've worn in the car to help with the pressure, books, movies, videos, all these things that have helped me and I hope will help you as an individual living with infertility, or if you have a friend or family member who's struggling, you can share that on medpsychmoss.com/infertility. Make sure you rate and also subscribe my podcast wherever you are. This allows individuals to see that this podcast is helpful. So thank you so much for joining in, and I'll see you for part two. Take care, everyone.